This is entitled 13 Contemplations from My Daily Practice, and it was originally going to be a sort of 15-minute mini-talk for a Western Region Order weekend we were going to have at the end of November, but the snow intervened. I got home just as the snow was falling and was then snowed in for 2 weeks, so they never got to hear the talk, Then Shantigarbha suggested, well, maybe I could expand it a bit and give it here. So we'll see if it scales up from 15 minutes or not. How did it come about? Why 13 contemplations? Well, it sort of arose a piecemeal. It arose a bit at a time. In a way, there is sort of personal reinterpretation of... Well, there's a number of lists of these sort of reminders in various parts of the Buddhist tradition. So in that sense, it doesn't really contain anything original. And I'm sure, in a sense and in a way, I suppose I'd maybe encourage people to make their own list with their own additions or deletions as they see fit. So the number 13 has got no particular significance. It started out as 10 and then I added 3 more. So it's not, as a friend of mine suggested the other day, the fact that 13 is a particularly mystically significant number and is in fact also the lowest prime number, which if you reverse the digits is also a prime number. That's of course if you're in base 10 notation. Yes, right, well... As I said, it started because I actually wanted something as a sort of insight element to put into my daily practice that was easy to do and as a spur to practice right here, right now, because a couple of years ago I sort of came up against things I felt I wasn't really changing hard enough. You know, I needed to make more effort, so I wanted a spur to make some more effort. And... what I decided to do was to create a sort of, if you like, a sort of contemplative insight element to go between a period of samatha practice, either mindfulness or metta, as I saw fit, and my daily sort of visualization practice. And it can be quite short, or you can extend the length of it, depending on how much you want to contemplate it. But I suppose in its most basic form, I just actually go through it as a list, and recite the list to myself, although, you know, I have been known to dwell on it for up to half an hour. So I'll just begin by telling you what the list is, and then I'll say something about some of the things in the list. So there are 13 things. I've got all my limbs, I've got all my senses, I've got my health, I've got leisure, I live in a land of political stability and rule of law, I've good friends, I've an excellent place to meditate, I've encountered the Dharma, I've found the best teacher, and I've gone for refuge to the three jewels. Death is certain, the time of death is unknown, and the only thing that will help at the time of death is the Dharma. That's the 13. hope I didn't go through them too fast, but I'll be going through them in a bit of detail now. So... you can see a bit more how I would dwell on them. In a way, they're all really quite obvious, and they're all things we know, and they're all fairly sort of undeniable sort of things. There's no great metaphysics involved in any of it. So the first three kind of go together. It is almost a sort of it's just as they came to me. So they don't particularly form a sort of coherent list in terms of types, you know, there's one category and then another. But the first three kind of go together. I've got all my limbs, I've got all my senses, and I've got my health. So the first three, in a sense, are about physical well-being. And obviously, I sort of think, well, I'm very lucky, I have got all of these things, and but I'm not getting any younger. My sight and hearing certainly aren't as good as they once were. I get tired more easily. I reflect a bit on the fact that I have had the good fortune to get to the age of nearly 59 with nothing having gone horribly wrong. I've got all my hair and only one tooth missing, which is pretty good going, really, considering. And particularly, I often bring to mind in this particular bit the fact that, there are people, you know, who've died at considerably younger ages than me. And at the moment, I still seem to have, you know, a reasonable degree of physical well-being. And there's also, if you like, the fact that I haven't, through my good luck and good fortune, really encountered any sort of serious accidental damage with accidents with things, although we'll come back to that a bit later. But all of this is impermanent, and I don't know how long I can rely on any of that. How long can I rely on having all my limbs, all my senses, and my health? At best, if I'm lucky, another 20 years, that would be pretty good going. Probably less. My health's only actually going to deteriorate. I mean, I can take good care of myself. I can eat good food, exercise, and have enough sleep, but old age will get me. And also, obviously, at this point, I also think about, well, actually resolving to do what I can to remain healthy as long as I possibly can, to practice the Dharma. Then we get to number four. I have leisure. There are texts that refer to being born in places of no leisure. And without leisure, it is actually very hard to practice the Dharma, because practice takes time. You need time to sit and meditate. You need time to study. You need time to engage with all the spiritual practices that we do. It all takes a fair amount of time. And I'm now actually fortunate enough to be in a position where I'm no longer working and have taken early retirement. And I consider this to be a great piece of good fortune that I've stopped working as young as I have. And sometimes I do, during this, just think about, in a sense, that a lot of my life has been occupied with work. I was working full-time from age of 21 to 55. You could say that as I started school at 5, actually, I'd been working from 5 to 55, which is 40 years. And that's a lot of no leisure. And indeed, I stopped working when I was 55 due to ill health. And during that 40-year period, the longest period of leisure to practice the Dharma seriously that I had, I suppose, was during my ordination retreat in Tuscany in 1983. So I think my conclusion from that is that I'm fortunate to have stopped working, and that work is definitely overrated as something to be doing too much of. I'm quite sceptical now, having not worked for a few years, about the value of too much work, and particularly as it's quite hard to reverse 40-odd years of conditioning to work hard. It is, in fact, a major area of personal practice, trying to undo the task-driven mentality that my various teachers and bosses inculcated into me from the age of 5 to 55. I have put here that a lot of school is about conditioning you to be a good and obedient worker. And I do see that as a definite, you know, even having got, in a sense, objective leisure, I still need to work at making sure that I do create spaces and don't just fill it up with leftover workaholism for having worked for a long time. And I say all that about work being overrated, despite the fact that I actually did the career I'd chosen for myself, which actually had a strongly mythic aspect to it, and I really enjoyed. But even so, work was overrated. And number five is a bit different. It's not so personal. I live in a land of political stability where there's the rule of law. I mean, our government and our systems of government are far from perfect, but I am living in a country and in an environment where I do have the freedom to practice whatever religious views I want. I'm no secret police come and take me away from being a Buddhist. The secular state actually has a lot to recommend it as a place to practice the Dharma freely. And of course there are quite a lot of places in the world where I wouldn't have those freedoms if I was there. is quite a large portion of humanity don't have basic freedom to practice whatever spiritual practice they choose. Sometimes people do say quite a lot of things that are critical about the modern secular state, and indeed there is stuff to be critical about it in, such as the rise of consumerism. But I think we should be careful to realise that there are actually a lot of benefits to the particular system of government and this particular sort of state we live under, although, as I say, they are far from perfect. They are actually quite good conditions to practice the Dharma. Sometimes I think in our efforts to analyse our society's faults, such as consumerism, we do tend to neglect a bit how fortunate we are to have that freedom. Number six in the list is I have good friends. I don't really have anything much to say on this one because a great many people in our order and our movement have spoken a great deal about friendship. All I really want to say about it is that I'm very glad that I do have a network of good friends that I've developed and am in contact with over many, many years, and that's a very great piece of good fortune. Number seven is that I have an excellent place to meditate. Well, I am lucky in this respect. I've managed to arrange my life so that I've got a quiet personal space, a shrine room, a summer house in a garden where I can meditate quietly and without interruption, except possibly for this last week when I've had the builders in. That's been not so quiet. But the importance of just having a space where you can quietly and conveniently meditate, and it's in a sense protected from incursions from the outside world, and that you can just get on with your practice. Again, that's an immense piece of good fortune that a lot of people don't have. I mean, I'm sure all of you try to set up the conditions to have a good meditation space, but a lot of things can conspire against that. Noise from the environment, where you have to live to do what you have to do. So I do consider myself very fortunate to have managed to create a space where I can meditate quietly and uninterruptedly. And number eight, I've encountered the Dharma. Now that's unusual. That's really unusual. Most beings haven't. I'm not quite sure how big the order is right now. I imagine it's somewhere between 1700 and 1800 people. I don't know what the latest statistic is. The world contains about 7 billion people, I think. So encountering the Dharma is rare. Even taking into account the much wider Buddhist world, encountering the Dharma in a meaningful form is still rare. And interestingly, you can encounter the Dharma in a non-meaningful form. One of the things I sometimes think about here is that it's quite easy to encounter the Dharma in a form that is indigestible. And this particular thing happened to me when I was about 17 or 18. I was in my sixth form at school. Somebody came and delivered a talk on Buddhism as part of our religious education. It was very dull, it was rather academic, and the presentation of the Buddhist teaching seemed to be all about getting to a point of non-existence. And I remember thinking, this is rubbish, why would I do that? And so from the age of 17 or 18, that was my first introduction to Buddhism, I gave it no more thought until age 27. So it is actually possible to encounter the Dharma in, well, nominally encounter the Dharma, but in actually a very unhelpful way. So I next encountered the Dharma at age 27, which again was almost accidental. This is the point, in a sense, I want to make, is that the fact that I'm here or not hinged on very small events. In particular, at age 27, it hinged on the very small event that I almost accidentally walked through the door of the Brighton Buddhist Centre. And by an interesting piece of synchronicity, my meditation teacher for that night is here at the back. There's Mangala. He taught me my first meditation. But me going through the door to learn that first meditation was, as I said, almost... I think it was 50-50 whether I went through that door. And the reason for that is that the only reason I was there was because I'd given my then wife a lift down there in order that she could learn to meditate. And I thought, oh, well, I'm not particularly interested in meditation. That Buddhism stuff didn't seem to be very relevant a few years ago. Maybe I'll just nip in the pub round the corner while she learns this thing. But the door looked reasonably inviting and the people smiled and I went in. And I learned to meditate. But it was... by no means, I didn't go there with any particular intention. I mean, when I did actually sit down to meditate, I had a very profound meditative experience, a very convincing experience of higher states of consciousness that went on for about the entire 20 minutes I was sitting there, and I think it's still informing my practice 32 years later. But I could very easily have not gone through that door at all. I could have just gone round the corner to the pub, and that would have been that. So I encountered the Dharma, but that's how much of a chance it was. I wasn't really looking for it. So that's there might be all sorts of reasons we could look at as to why that happened, but it certainly was by no means a foregone conclusion. Number nine, I suppose I might phrase this slightly contentiously. Is number nine is I found the best teacher. Well, I certainly think I found the best teacher. If I didn't think I'd found the best teacher in Sangharakshita, it really would be my duty as a practicing Buddhist to move on and find the best teacher. And I have no reason to be convinced that he's not the best teacher. Again, you'll have heard many talks about Sangharakshita and his unique elucidation of the Dharma for our current times of the 20th and 21st century. So in a way, I'll... just confine myself to a small amount of personal experience about why I think he's the best teacher, at least for me, and that I have absolutely no desire to have anyone else to follow as my teacher of the Dharma. Often, in terms of the daily reflection here, I just marvel at how on earth he managed to produce the survey at such a young age. Now, how is that possible? I think he was about 29 or 30. I mean, I'm nearly 59. I couldn't write 6 pages like that now, never mind a book full of it. You know, so it's just quite remarkable, his elucidation of the Dharma. How is it possible he did that? And when I was ordained into the order in 1983... I think I was probably something about like number 203 on the order list. So already the order was too large for Sangharakshita to have really sort of personal close relationships with a lot of his disciples. You know, he was already relying on other more senior order members to sort of assist him with that. But so in a sense... at the time of my ordination, there was a certain sort of ambiguity about, in a sense, our relationship still had to be tested, although I was quite happy to, you know, believe that his was the best teaching and go for refuge and everything like that. But over the intervening years and decades, there have been a number of times when I've really needed his advice. I'm not quite sure how many times. Not that many, maybe 6, maybe 8. But when I really needed to ask him something that somebody else couldn't answer, when I actually needed a piece of spiritual advice that really mattered, either in relation to my own continued existence in the order, or in relation to the well-being of one or more of my friends, and it's been both, sometimes it's been in regard to the fact that I've had something important spiritually that I need to sort out for myself, or in, I would say, half the cases, it's because I've gone to him with something where, you know, someone else is in a certain amount of difficulty and I want to help and I want advice. But on all those occasions, he's always been very able and very willing to give me the help and advice I need. And I'm very sort of confident that if I needed to ask him something crucial like that again, he would be there for me, at least as long as he's still with us, as long as he's still alive. I'm very confident that if I need that sort of help, it is there. I mean, as I said, he's old now, and it's not good to bother him too often, at least not in my opinion, but I'm very confident that I would get the time if it was something important, and that I would get an answer that was relevant. And then number 10 on the list, I've gone for refuge to the Three Jewels. Well, actually, that's really quite extraordinary in itself. Not many people do that. I mean, again, we're back to the 1700, 1800 order members. Even if you take the wider Buddhist world, you know, how many people have actually effectively gone for refuge to the Three Jewels? Probably not that many. Thousands? Tens of thousands, if we're lucky, I don't know. But not a lot out of the 7 billion or so on the planet. So how unusual is all that? So we got to the end of the first 10, and in a sense these were the first ones I created. I added the last three later on. So collectively I then tend to think, well, how unusual to have all this. How much merit all this contains. You know, this is sort of gobsmackingly unusual to have got into this position where I've got all these 10 things. You know, what else would I want? You know, this is a very meritorious life. Don't waste this very unusual opportunity. I mean, there's that thing in some Mahayana sutra, I'm afraid I can't recall which one, about the turtle surfacing every 1,000 years and putting his head through a yolk floating on a vast ocean. And that seems to be a similar degree of improbability, that I've managed to have all these 10 things in my life. How unusual is that? In terms of the vast number of human beings that there are, very unusual. And as I put here, don't waste this very unusual opportunity, particularly because, as number 11, death is certain. I am still bargaining about this one. I still don't quite believe it. Foolish, I know, but I still don't quite believe it. I bargain about it in various ways. Obviously, I bargain about it by simply ignoring the fact. And I also bargain about it by occasionally playing with and thinking about more scientific solutions, such as uploading my consciousness to a silicon substrate or some other form of transhuman consciousness transferal. But I think on the whole, I'm going to have to at some point agree that death is actually certain. Unfortunate but true. And given the 10 things, given there's, you know, even assuming I'm reasonably confident about rebirth, what confidence could you have that you would get those 10 things again? In my next life, I might turn left and go in the pub. You never know. I've only got those 10 first things until death. I can't guarantee I'll get any of those in a future life. Which again is a rather a spur to practice, particularly as whatever the time of death, and the time of death is unknown, is number 12. That time is shortening. The time of death is unknown is something I actually do feel quite keenly, because I do reflect at this point on the quite substantial number of attempts on my life that samsara has already made. I am lucky to still be here. Everything from childhood measles, 2 serious car accidents that could have been fatal with very slightly altered conditions, three serious electric shocks. I was an electronic engineer and worked with very high voltages for many years, but even if you're careful, they happen to you from time to time. When I say serious electric shocks, I don't mean something that gives you a little bite. I mean something serious where you're getting close to loss of consciousness or burnt or something like that. Other industrial near misses with x-rays, rotating machinery and compressed air in the bloodstream. I have had a rather interesting industrial life. There were my chemistry experiments as a teenager. I made quite a lot of fireworks as a teenager. I do remember one particular occasion where the thing started to fizz on the bench where I was working and I hurled it out the window just in time. There have been quite a lot of things which could have got me up to this point, and including another one here, near drowning in Spain. My rescuer from that one is also in the room, actually. And he said rather laconically, after he finally pulled me out of the water, that he was on the point of letting me go and saving himself. So again, it was another time I only just got away with it. Yes. Yeah, not sure he's here anyway. I think that's actually average number of attempts on your life if you count it up that St. Clara's made, although maybe I did have a particularly interesting industrial life. But I'm still here. Why am I still here is perhaps a better question to ask at this point. So the time of death is unknown. I do actually feel that quite keenly, because I think a number of those ones could have been it, and I would simply have died for, oh no, oh, that's it. And number 13 is the only thing that can help you at the time of death is the Dharma. It's the only thing you can take with you, your mind. One additional thing I do reflect on here about the fact that the only thing that will help you at the time of death is the Dharma is that I really do believe in the value of preparation and practice in advance, because the time of death is uncertain and you can't leave it till later. There may be no later. And also, I'm very aware that if I get ill, I lose all mindfulness. I really do refuse to rely on the idea that I'll somehow have a good death, you know, a positive death, where, you know, it's all emotionally positive and people are wishing me well and things like that. It may not happen like that at all. I mean, if any of these things on the previous page had happened, it wouldn't have happened like that at all. I'd just have been dead on the floor, or dead in the sea. And also, I do know that when I am in pain and when I am ill, I lose all mindfulness. I'm one of those ones. I'm just going to be yelling for morphine. I'm not going to be having a mindful and composed death. I mean, I suppose I might, but I certainly wouldn't wish to rely on it. The only time I can actually, in a sense, make a useful dent in my conditioning and actually practice the Dharma is now. While I've still got the good conditions, I'm certainly not going to rely on the idea of having good conditions at a point close to death, because I know that at points when I've been close to death, I haven't been able to reflect on the Dharma. I'm just not up to it. I'm not capable of it. I'm in too much pain. I'm too frightened. I just can't do it. So it is a matter of building up merit now. So that's the personally composed list, and as I said, I intersperse it between. I put some samatha meditation first, and then my visualization practice afterwards. And as I said, you can take as little or as long as you like about it, anywhere between 2 minutes and half an hour. And I also invite you to use as little or as much of it as you like personally in your own practice, or even compose your own version. As I said, my version is a bit ad hoc. It's just things that came to me that seemed important. I'm sure you could rewrite the list in any number of other ways that would be equally useful. It's just a set of topics that sort of resonated with me that I felt would induce enough enough one-pointedness and need to practice the Dharma now that I would actually get on and do it. And so if any of you do find it personally applicable, I hope you find it encouraging, and please do feel free to make use of it in whatever way you would like to in your own practice.